Panthers, Browns, tomorrow night, 7 p.m. It's on your flagship home for Cleveland Browns football, 92.3 The Fan. And joining us right now on the Fan Hotline, Amanda will be on the call on News 5, where you can watch it. We'd prefer you listen, but if you're going to watch it, of course, the great Joe Thomas. He will be a part of that broadcast, and he is a Hall of Famer. Once a Hall of Famer, always a Hall of Famer, a Browns legend, a Browns analyst, number one in our hearts, 73 in the program. Joe Thomas joins us on the show. Joe, how the hell are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for that awesome introduction. We hope you don't watch him on Friday, but if you have to, it's not going to be that bad. Thanks for that one, Ken.
It'll be good. It will be good. I said you'd be good. You and Chris and Aditi, it's a great time.
Yes, yes. No, I'm just teasing you, man. We're excited. We're down here in Charlotte all week for the joint practices. And, of course, tomorrow, that first preseason game, we're going to get that first look at Shedeur Sanders. And I know there's a lot of Browns fans that are pretty excited to see that.
Okay, I'm going to get to Shedeur. Everybody wants to hear about Shedeur. I'm going to give it to him right off the rip. You want me to go positive or you want me to go concerning first?
Well, let's go concerning first so we finish with an upswing.
Sensational. Pre-snap penalties. I got wind of it. I'm worried about it. Can't have it. Got to cut it down.
Yeah, I mean, that's really been one of the biggest concerns, I think, with Shedeur, just like any young rookie quarterback thus far, because, hey, it's different when all of a sudden you're running plays under center. You got a new snap count. You got a bunch of different things to think about with shifts and formations and all the other knuckleheads on the outside who are also young trying to figure things out. So you got a lot going on. And of course, once the ball snapped, you got some things you got to do too as well. So there's a lot going on when you're a young quarterback, and there has been quite a few procedural penalties. And that's the first thing that you want to see cleaned up in that first game.
Obviously, every team around the NFL says they want to work on turnovers and penalties. And you, in your career with the Browns, you had teams that were penalized a lot. You were teams that were not penalized so much. Is it just randomness, or is it a different accountability? Is it a different teaching point every year, every week, really?
Yeah, I think the great thing in coaching is you get from the players what you emphasize. So if you're a team that emphasizes discipline, you emphasize reducing penalties and self-inflicted wounds, that's usually what you're going to get. Now, of course, situationally, and of course, scheme has something to do with that, and definitely personnel. You know, you got Myles Garrett there. He's probably going to get a few more sack fumbles and force a few more turnovers. Same thing if you're running some high-flying offense that's throwing the ball a ton. Of course, you're probably going to have a few more turnovers. Well, and great, there's a giant fire engine coming right by now, right now. But a lot of it is dictated by the situation and then what the coaching staff is going to emphasize. So I think this year, when you're a team that wants to lean on your defense and you want to lean on your running game, minimizing those self-inflicted wounds is going to be crucial for the Browns.
Joe Thomas joining us here on the show. Joe Flacco got all the first team reps yesterday in the joint practice. Is that a good idea?
Well, I think he is your likely starter for week one. And as great as it is to develop the young guys and get all the other players ready to play, there's still a season to play. And week one is going to be the most important thing that you're working towards right now to give yourself an opportunity to get some wins, right? I mean, I know a lot of people in Brown's world are looking, hey, we need to find a quarterback. We got two first-round picks next year. We need to find out about these guys. Yes, we do. But let's have a little patience. Pump the brakes a little bit on that, because I think that there's a lot of guys in this building, after watching how this offensive line plays, how this defensive line plays, how that defense plays, and then seeing Joe Flacco throwing the ball around like he's still maybe 35 years old a couple decades ago when he was in his 30s. And thinking, hey, this is still a team that can make some noise, so I'm not ready to give up on them yet and start playing for a quarterback next year.
Joe Thomas with us right now. Obviously, our discussion has been centered a lot around their handling of the quarterbacks, their allocation of reps, and of course, where Shedeur sticks in that, because he's the most famous guy. He's the most popular guy for a lot of fans out there. What have you noticed, and what is your takeaway by even being there yesterday and how they operated?
Well, I think talking to people in the building, everybody's been very impressed with Shedeur Sanders and how serious and driven and motivated he is to be great. I mean, he's doing all the things right. And really, some of the noise that you hear on the outside and some of the controversy around how Shedeur is being handled is not the feeling within the building, because he's doing everything right. I think he understands the plan, too, and he doesn't want to get thrown to the wolves right away, but he wants an opportunity. And it's been great. You know, Dylan Gabriel had a little bit of an injury this week. Same thing with Kenny Pickett. So they were out of the rotation for a little while. So Shadur had an opportunity to get in there a little bit more. And he made some really nice plays. And he showed up in the way that you saw him show up when he was in college, making some really beautiful, accurate throws, timing throws down the field. And so I think when you get that confirmation against an NFL defense of some guy that was doing it in college, you wonder how he's going to make that transition to the next level. And then he does it in training camp practices, especially against another team like the joint practices this week and next week. You start to feel really good about him. Now you start to think, okay, now we need to find a way to get him a few more reps. Still getting Joe Flacco ready, probably to start, but let's get Shadur a few more reps, get him the majority of the number two reps, those opportunities to grow and see how quickly he can grow and learn this offense.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Joe Thomas joining us here on the show. You have worked with DeJuan Jones in the offseason. You're down with him there. Saw some video of him looking good. Lyman and I got a chance to talk to him last week. What's been the secret to trying to unlock the potential of DeJuan Jones at left tackle?
Well, I think between any player and any coach, to get the most out of each other, you got to have that trust. And I think just being friendly and friends with DeJuan since they brought him in here, even though this is the first time I've had a chance to really work with him, I think it goes a long way because you build a little relationship and you build that trust outside of, hey, here's this guy. Supposedly he knows what he's talking about. Listen to him for a couple of days. You know, there's some trust built there. There's some relationship. So coming in and helping think, okay, DeJuan, this is my checklist when I would go to line of scrimmage. This is my checklist pre-practice. This is my process of how I figured out what are the things I'm not doing well? How do I work on those things? And really, you have to be self-motivated and self-driven. And you have to be a little bit of a self-taught person when you're playing in the NFL because you have an offensive line coach, great offensive line coach. He knows technique. He knows scheme. He's going to put you in the right position. But there's not enough of them to coach you on every single play, on every single rep, on every single second of every meeting. So you've got to take that accountability and put it on your own shoulders. That's how you become a great player. And so for me, just trying to teach him some of the little foundational principles of playing the position and then teaching him a process of how he evaluates himself every single day and how he identifies areas that he needs to improve on.
Joe Thomas joining us on the show. Let me ask you about yourself for a second. How would you grade yourself about how you're coming along coaching? Because I think it's very hard for guys who did it at the highest level. Because you know, we saw with Wayne Gretzky, he admitted, he's like, I don't understand how they can't do this. And it's always stuck out to me because it's like, okay, Joe, I mean, you had to work hard, but you know, you're a big, strong, tall guy, very athletic. Like, there's a natural ability there. How do you get that to translate to the players?
Well, it was such a benefit for me being able to spend last year over in Europe as the offensive line coach of the Munich Ravens, because I had 11 guys who had a lot less football experience than the guys I'm working with now in Cleveland. And you really had to go back to the drawing board almost in your mind, right? Because you played at a pretty high level and the way you think about the game is sort of graduate calculus level. And you have to bring it back to the foundational principles of offensive line play. And so going back to January when I moved to Germany and having an opportunity to work with those guys one-on-one in the off season, doing the drills and seeing their improvement. And then also just seeing like what doesn't work. Like, hey, it worked for me. It was something that I did a lot, but I've got 11 guys and we worked on it for 9 months and it didn't help them. So, all right, that goes out the door, right? You have to check your ego. And I think that's one of the harder things for guys that, you know, have had successful NFL careers or really in any sport. If you've made the Hall of Fame or if you had a great career, you've got to have an ability to check your ego if you're a coach, because there are some things, like you said with Wayne, that the guys just won't be able to do. And instead of getting frustrated, all right, let's have no ego about this. Let's not put it on the players. Oh, you're not smart enough or you're not good enough. No. All right, let's find another way to do this. Let's find a different way to learn. Let's find a different way to get to them to be able to get the same outcome. And I think that experience for me was just tremendously valuable, not only just from running an offensive line room and running practice, but being able to understand like different ways to get at each one of the players to get the outcome you want.
Joe Thomas with us. I wanted to ask you about, I don't know if you've heard in the NBA, there's a discussion throughout the years of two timelines with certain teams. Like when Golden State had these awesome veterans who had won championships, but then had a batch of rookies. And it proved to be really hard to be able to accomplish two things at once. And I wonder sometimes about the Browns when it comes to that, because you have these aging veterans and then you also have these young, exciting rookies that you want to develop. How hard is it to do that with an NFL time period condensed now like it is with training camp? Because before you know it, after next week, it's going to be all about getting the team ready for week one.
Well, it's really hard in the NFL, but the only cheat code is having a great quarterback, because that's the guy who's probably going to be able to play the longest. You know, we got a 40-plus-year-old quarterback right now. He's on, what, 18 years in the NFL or so? And that's a guy that he can be that person, that steadying force, that rock in that organization, who's the consistent leader, the consistent voice. He's the guy that sets the culture. He's the one that everybody follows in times of adversity. He's the guy that gets people to show up when maybe they'd rather go and hang out some other country and go travel with their family or their friends. Like, having that guy at the quarterback position really is the ultimate cheat code. And I mean, it's no surprise. It's the most important position in football. They pay these guys twice what they pay anybody else because they're worth it, right? And so really that quarterback is the only thing that can give you that consistent level of success year in and year out. The Patriots did it forever. And you saw, hey, Belichick, greatest coach of all time, but all of a sudden Brady's not there. Well, maybe the system and the coaching's not that much of a difference maker that we thought it was.
Is that why, Joe, I mean, the experience is one thing, but I mean, we've had old quarterbacks play for us before, for crying out loud. That didn't work. But I mean, there is this leadership. I mean, he's a Super Bowl MVP. He's a guy who's been a multiple-time Pro Bowler back when Pro Bowls meant something there. Is that part of the reason why he, like, hey, we know things could happen. It's a weird year, but this guy's going to start the year to try to get us off on the right foot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any inside knowledge over who they think is going to be the starter. I mean, there was some talk about Kenny Pickett maybe winning the job earlier in training camp because he was looking really good, and then he got dinged up a little bit and then has been out. And I don't know if that means he's still not in the conversation as one of the starters, but I think after having experienced quarterback rooms where you've got a young guy and you've got a couple young backups behind him, you know, I think it's tough because – going back to what I said about being an O-line coach, okay, you're an O-line coach. You could be the greatest O-line coach in the history of the world, but if there's no O-linemen in that room who are buying into what you're selling, who believe in your culture, and who can spend the time one-on-one at an O-line dinner or when you're over at somebody's house or in the locker room, you just have more access. And I think there's even a higher level of trust among your teammates, especially when you have a veteran guy like a Joe Flacco that can impart wisdom and knowledge and process upon Shadur and Dylan and Kenny Pickett to some extent, that I think that's invaluable. That's why you see so many of these veteran quarterbacks sticking around, even guys that don't really play much, because it's so valuable to have that player coach in that room that can help and that can guide and give wisdom and experience. And without them, like, who knows what you're going to get? You might get some good. You're probably going to get some bad. But the guys in that room don't have that experience to know that if they are doing and saying some of the right things, if they're building the right process, because at some point that coach is going to go upstairs and they've got coaches' meetings that they've got to attend and they've got to get ready for practice and they've got to do game plan and scheme. And at that point, the players are left to their own devices to figure things out.
Joe Thomas with us on the show. You were with a lot of rookie QBs, guys who either didn't have it or had their head up their ass or whatever reason it was. What is the biggest mistake Dylan Gabriel or Shedeur Sanders can make with the team as rookie QBs?
I think the biggest mistake you would make is trying to act like you are the guy before you have earned it on the field. And neither of those guys have, so I'm not saying that they have, but I think watching rookie quarterbacks, like, if you don't have those pelts on the wall and all of a sudden you're the guy that wants to break it down and you're not doing what you're supposed to do, then that's a real difficult thing because guys aren't going to follow you. I heard something a while ago early on in my NFL career that said, like, if you want to be a great leader, it starts with doing the things right on the field and in the meeting room. And that's what guys are watching and that's what guys see. And then if you want to be the guy that comes up and gives us those rah-rah speeches and is the one that's coaching everybody on the field, that's perfect. That's exactly what we want. but you've got to be able to put it together on the field. You got to prove to the teammates that you can do it, that you're doing all the right things, and that you're going above and beyond what they're doing. So I think the guys right now, they're doing a great job of that. And I think it really does help having that Joe Flacco in the meeting room, because he is such a great leader and he has such great experience, and he can be such a great teacher for them.
Joe Thomas with us on the show. Last one. Almost called him Flacco again.
Thank you.
Got Flacco on the brain. I'm sorry, Joe. I asked you this last night. I want to ask you again. Mike Bloomgren, new offensive line coach. I was excited. And then I had a lot of people calling me dumb because, you know, it didn't go well at Rice. I don't know when the last time it has gone well at Rice, but regardless, what does Mike Bloomgren bring to the table?
Well, I'll just say, you know, you're a product as a coach of the players that you coach. And, you know, I've had some coaches that weren't that great, but had great offensive lines. And I've had some great coaches, and we just weren't able to get it done. But I think Mike Bloomgren's a great coach. Just being able to be around him this week. I went to dinner with him last night, getting to know him a little bit better. Like, I see the things that he's teaching. I see how he's getting through to the players. I see how he's working with DeJuan and how DeJuan has been bought in to his coaching style and what he's teaching. And I think he's got a great, consistent voice of what he wants. And that's so important. Just reflecting on my own time in Munich again, I think one of the challenges for me was seeing so much and having lived 11 years in the NFL and having that higher level of knowledge, but understanding that sometimes guys aren't ready for all that, right? And sometimes you have to be able to be a clear, concise communicator and not give them everything at once. Just give them little breadcrumbs along the way. And I see Coach Bloomgren doing that. He's doing a great job with these guys. And, you know, who knows what the season brings. It was only one practice, but offensive line had a great day yesterday against the Carolina Panthers, who have a pretty good front seven. And I think the team was really happy after watching how they performed together. Obviously, we got four veterans who you expect great performance. But I think DeJuan bringing up his game and starting to play at their level, I think this is a really exciting offensive line for me this year.
Joe Thomas, Hall of Famer. Check him out online, sixspringsfarms.com. Joe, we thank you very much for the time. We'll talk to you when you get back in town.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me on this morning.
Joe Thomas on the Fan Hotline.
And give us a little bit of his time is Browns wide receiver Jerry Jeudy. Hey, how are you? Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Jerry.
Well, we appreciate you. You know, the thing I go back and I think about last season, and I think about the great history of this franchise, and when you can have a tag that says most single season receptions at 90, man, that's something special when you put on a Browns uniform. Just your reflections on last year and what it was like for you to get that first year in Cleveland under your belt.
You know, it felt amazing, you know, being able to get put in a position to really showcase my talent and show the NFL and the team that exactly who I am as a receiver. And, you know, and just take advantage of every opportunity, you know, I'm very appreciative of Coach Stefanski and the coaching staff to really allow me to be who I am as a receiver and just continue to grow from there.
Jerry, I thought your years in Denver were disappointing because I don't think they used you the way that I was hoping that they would use you, because real good talent coming out of Alabama, obviously. Here in Cleveland, they were looking at you a different way. What did that do for you as a player?
Yeah, I mean, it gave me the extreme confidence to go out there and really perform to the best of my ability. Just being able to having my skill set used to my best ability as possible, which is running routes and get open. And I feel like Cleveland has put me in that right position to be able to do that. And, you know, I just took advantage of it.
How much of that is just change of scenery? Just being in a new place with new coaches and, you know, and Jameis is a pretty fun guy to have throw you the ball, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think a change of scenery was huge for me. You know, just to go to another team to show, like, what I actually do on a day-to-day basis in practice and how I run my routes and how I get open, and they understanding and actually utilizing my skill set. You know, so, you know, it was a big moment for me to transition over here and just, you know, being able to do what I do best, and that's run routes.
Jerry Jeudy joining us, Browns wide receiver. Let me throw some names at you. Drew Lock, Teddy Bridgewater, Russell Wilson, Sean Watson, Jameis Winston. Man, I hope you get a quarterback for more than 2 years in a row. Russell Wilson's the only guy you've had two straight years, correct?
Yeah, Russell, the only guy I had two. Yeah.
That, how tough is that on a wide receiver, Jerry?
You know, it's very tough. You all, as a receiver, you know, you want to be able to have your quarterbacks that you know you're going to go into the season with, build relationship throughout the offseason with, and just have consistency in at the quarterback position. You know, it's all big for receivers. So, you know, it's pretty challenging, but at the end of the day, man, you got to go out there and do your job and make it easier for whoever bet that quarterback.
Can you tell me a little bit about Tommy Rees and what you will expect out of him as an offensive coordinator, and is there any kind of little Alabama bond between the two of you guys? I know you weren't there at the same time, but that's got to make you feel a little comfortable.
Yeah, you know, just a little bit. You know, we wasn't there at the same time, but he's still a part of the coaching staff, so, you know, I still consider him one of the Bama brotherhoods for sure. So, you know, I can't complain there. You know, Tommy been doing a great job and just putting up the schemes for the offense and just moving guys around and setting up certain plays, you know. So I'm very excited to see what Tommy do this year.
Can you talk about the difference with him being in that role this year and then overall with camp? Like, we were out there on Wednesday and you guys went live, and everyone looked at each other and was like, they just went live. And that's just something Kevin hadn't done before.
Yeah, you know, you just want to callous the guys up, you know, just being, you know, we're going to go live. We got a scrimmage, this upcoming Friday, you know. So just building catalysts and just, you know, preparing ourselves for the real game.
Jerry, last year you had Amari Cooper here, and he wasn't here for a whole lot of time. But it put you in the position, okay, here's Amari, and here I come in here. This year you're the guy on this team, and everybody else is following your lead at wide receiver. With that in mind, how has Cedric Tillman looked coming back from his concussion situation? And how is Deontay Johnson looking, trying to bounce back after a year that was a very strange one for him?
Cedric, he's been doing great. You know, he's been coming in, working hard, doing what he's supposed to do, being coached well, you know, and doing what he's supposed to do on the field. You know, Deontay been doing the same thing as well. You know, them two of the guys that, you know, we could depend on this year, and they've been doing a tremendous job on and off the field and just preparing themselves for practice and preparing themselves for the season.
Jerry, if those two guys step up and just do what they've done in the past, I think you guys have a nice receiving group. But there are question marks with both of those guys. How do you help as the guy who's leading that position group? How do you help eliminate those question marks for those guys?
Basically, you know, the only way they can eliminate the question marks for those guys to do what they've been doing in practice and just show it on Sundays. You know, a lot of people probably, you know, Deontay Johnson caught a lot of balls in his league. I think people forgot about that. You know, and Cedric Tillman had a good year last year before he got that concussion. So, you know, even though DNC, you know, Deontay had 100 something catches a few years ago. Cedric had a good year last year but got hurt. They're still the same guys, you know, ain't nothing changed, you know, they only getting better. So, you know, kudos to those guys, you know, and we're going to keep working and doing what we're supposed to do to be better on Sundays.
Yeah, Jerry, I haven't forgot how good Deontay can be and what he's done. And as I, you know, we talked about just you change of scenery to come here. What do you think that change of scenery has done for Deontay? Because I would love to see him have another big year here in Cleveland, because I'd love to turn the page on what happened before.
Yeah, for sure. You know, he understand where he at with his whole process right now. You know, this is chance to really showcase what he's about. Just come here and do what he's supposed to do, work hard and show what everybody been missing out on the field. You know, that's the only thing he could do, and that's the only thing he could ask for.
Jerry Jeudy joining us, Browns wide receiver. I mentioned all the quarterbacks you've had before. You got four different ones this year, Jerry. How are you trying to build some chemistry with the rookies, with the two veterans? How's that going, and how's that feel for you?
You know, it's going good, man. The most thing I'm thankful for is having four great guys really out there coming to compete and work hard every day and get better each day, you know. But, you know, at the end of the day, man, I only can control what I can control, and that's to run routes and just make the job easier for the quarterbacks, you know, and that's what I'm going to continue to do.
How's Flacco's arm look? Probably not like a 40-year-old?
No, I definitely don't look like a 40-year-old, you know. Flacco coming out here every day competing, you know, getting better, you know. And, you know, he got that beautiful arm that he always had.
Hey, what's the difference between a rookie quarterback and a veteran quarterback? I was listening. Shador sounds like a veteran. You heard him right before he came on, before you came on with us. Like, what's the biggest thing rookies, whether it's quarterback or not, what do they need to learn?
You know, I think the biggest thing is just reps. You know, a rookie, they never been in the league. This is his first year in the league, so, you know, he don't got a lot of repetition on his belt, you know. And a vet that had all the reps, he been in the league, what, 20, 40 years now, so he got all the My bad, Joe, not to put you out there now, but, you know, you're still,
that's all right.
You're still my boy, but, you know. You know, he got the reps under his belt, you know, so he knows different, you know what to look for too when it comes to Sunday, different coverages, different schemes. He understands that, you know, the younger guys don't.
Does the offense feel
towards learning that?
I'm sorry, Jerry. Does the offense feel real different to you this year with Tommy Rees as coordinator and maybe a little change in philosophy, or are there a lot of similarities?
It's a lot of similarities. It's not really too much change of play callings or plays. It's a lot of things we did last year, you know. Tommy just added his little tweets to it, but it's nothing different at all.
Jerry, how do you like living in Cleveland? I always wonder that.
I enjoy living in Cleveland, man. Just how big the fan base is and the love they got for the Cleveland Browns, man. That's the type of atmosphere I love. You know, just like I came from Alabama, that's kind of the same atmosphere that I had at Alabama. You know. They don't have no professional teams other than Alabama, you know. But in Cleveland, they love their Cleveland Browns football. So, you know, I enjoy that a lot.
Were you surprised at all? I mean, even just the difference between Denver and Cleveland. Just like, is this city what you thought it was going to be when you got here?
You know, I came here when I was in Denver. I came here and I just seen the atmosphere of the Cleveland Browns football. So I knew a little bit about it, but I don't really know too much until I stepped foot and actually been here for a little while, you know, and it's exactly what I expected.
All right, Jerry, go get another record. We'll take 91 receptions this year. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds great. You know, but I'll take a little bit more than that.
All right, we'll take more, too.
Like
Jerry, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, let's go to the fan hotline. We welcome in Mike Lombardi, who joins us
right now.
Mike, good morning to you. You are the author of Football Done Right and your current general manager of University of North Carolina football. We've had John many times before. We're happy to have you again here, Michael. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Lima, ask Michael the question just asked.
The question about Dillon Gabriel, his size, comes up often with shorter quarterbacks in the NFL, but yet Baker Mayfield has been unbelievable the last few years in Tampa Bay. He's not a tall guy. We know about Drew Brees. So how big of a deal is size at quarterback in the NFL?
Well, I mean, look, Steve Young was barely 6 foot. He's in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, I think a lot of it is throwing angles. Do they get balls batted down the line? Early in Baker's career, he got a lot of balls batted down, at least 6 a game, and he was able to finally figure out how to slide and move in the pocket to create the launch point to where he's not going to get passes batted down. I mean, when you get a pass batted down, it's a win for the defense. It's not a sack, but it's almost like a sack. So I think a lot of that. Look, Dillon Gabriel, go back and watch his Oregon tape. My son was the quarterback coach at Oregon last year, coached him. And, you know, he barely got a ball batted down. He had great angle to throw the football. He had really good rhythm to understand where he needed to put the ball. And I think in time he's going to become a good player. Will he become a starter? I don't know. You know, we got to wait and see on that. It's hard to start in the National Football League. For quarterbacks, you got to be able to do it week in and week out. But I think this kid certainly got instincts and he's got anticipation, which is what you need to be an effective quarterback.
But Mike, this setup in general, normally you want to get the best out of quarterbacks and figure out a way to do that. Sometimes it's going to be up to them. But here you have two veterans and you have two rookies, and those rookies taken the third and fifth round. I don't know how you evaluate those quarterbacks, give them enough reps with your joint practices and preseason games to truly get the best out of them. Can it be done?
You know, you just asked the most important question about football. Football is a mathematical problem. Okay, there's that, and no one understands this. There's only so many reps every day at practice. And how you divide those reps is most critical in terms of how you're building your team. Because if you're giving 20 reps a day to a guy who's not going to ever play for you, you're wasting 20 reps. And once you determine what value you have in the player, who do you need to develop? Who don't you need to develop? It's impossible to develop two young quarterbacks at the same time. It's not college. We don't have 400 players on the field like they used to in college, where you could take everybody and move them to a side field and then go over. So to me, it's a very challenge. When you draft a guy in the third and then you come back and pick a guy in the fifth, it becomes very difficult. Look, Al Davis picked a quarterback in the first round from Tennessee State, and in the second round he picked Kenny Stabler. I wrote about it in Football Done Right. Now, how did he do that? Well, they had, you know, they were able, that was a different time and period in the NFL, but I think it's really challenging today based on the rules and based on how much time you can be on the practice field. After you're up there, 2:45, that horn blows, and if you're not off the field, the Players Association is going to call you up. So it's challenging.
Michael Lombardi joining us on the show, former Browns front office member, former NFL executive, current general manager, North Carolina football. There's one player you recruited I'd like to ask you about coming up here in just a moment here, Michael. But, and of course, the book, Football Done Right, Setting the Record Straight on Coaches, Players, and History of the NFL. So there has been some conversation, not by this show, but there has been some conversation about like starting Dylan Gabriel week one. It sounds like you would feel that that's pretty irresponsible.
Well, I think it would be a challenge. It would be hard to put the kid in a position where he could be successful. Look, the quarterback position, and you're the head coach of the team, you got to be able to stand in front of the team and say, this player gives us the best chance to win the game. And I think that's really hard to do on rookie quarterbacks. You know, now, sometimes you're forced to do it. Pittsburgh was forced to do it when Tommy Maddox got hurt, and all of a sudden Ben Roethlisberger had to go play. So that's a different element. But I think it's really challenging for some rookie to come in and say, look at Caleb Williams. I mean, last year he was talked about as the greatest savior to the franchise. How many games did he win for the Bears? You know, how many mistakes did he make that hurt his team? So I think rookies are, you know, now look, Jaden Daniels did a tremendous job for their team, but that's a few and far between. I think it would be unfair to any young quarterback to put him into the fire, especially if you're not going to build your team around, look, we're going to win with defense, we're going to win with kicking game, we're going to run the ball, and we're going to limit the quarterback. That's hard to do in the NFL.
Mike Lombardi with us. The Shedeur Sanders, the specter of him just at training camp, he has said all the right things. There's been no distraction in terms of his dad, film crews, any of that stuff out here. In fact, he's been one of the first guys there, last guys to leave, always putting in the extra work. With that said, as a fifth-round pick, how much of a shot does he really have here with this Browns team in 2025?
Well, I think, most what people don't understand about the NFL draft is it's always for your next year's team. It's never for the current team. Certainly, you'll get some production out of a draft pick during the current year, but really what you're building on is for the 26 team. He's not the 25 team. You know, could he go in and play? Perhaps. Would he be effective? Probably not fair to the kid. So I think ultimately every draft class is for the next year's team. You should be evaluating the 24 draft class for the Browns this year. How's that going to line up in terms of impacting their team and getting them over the top? That's really the fundamental question. As for the Shedeur Sanders media circus, I mean, look, that's created by the worldwide leader. No one loves to talk about one thing more than they do. And so that really is not the kid's fault that they do it all the time.
Michael Lombardi joining us on the show. So what do you did you ever get a chance to really evaluate him, or have you just been?
No, I've been too busy watching high school quarterbacks. So I didn't know. I mean, this is probably the one draft since I've been out of the league that I really didn't pay any attention to, because my job is to find players for North Carolina, and I no longer have to do the media circuit and understand about that. So I'm pretty content just watching high school tape now.
One of those guys, you did bring in Mason Wilhelm. He's our friend's son out of St. Ed's. What are you expecting for that young man?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping he has a great senior year. You know, I think that's really important to keep developing. Look, offensive lineman, we're excited about him. He's tough. Our whole program is built on being tough, smart, and dependable, and I think that's what Mason clearly is, and that's what we're looking forward in terms of him playing and coming here to North Carolina with a great education and all that. So, look, the one thing all high school players have to do, you know, everybody commits, but the reality of it is, you know, they got to finish their high school, they got to finish strong, and the most important thing is handling their team.
You know, we are at an unprecedented time in youth sports and the cost to do all of this stuff. We talk about it all the time here. We got some fathers in the room. They're paying a lot of money for this stuff. Our listeners are paying a lot of money. You have a chance now to go back and look at high school football players. How do you compare them to, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Are they any better off with all this money being spent?
Well, I mean, the training's so much better. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, they got better training, weight lift. We actually know what we're doing. I mean, do you remember we used to not give water to players during practice? I mean, so I think we've come a long way in that area. But for the most part, I mean, look, the kids are bigger, stronger, tougher, all that. And that really helps.
Michael Lombardi joining us on the show. Listen, I do want to keep it to football. I'm going to keep it to football with you. For the head coach at North Carolina, Bill Belichick, what has this been like for him? Has this been like kind of a new lease on coaching for him? Has this been invigorating for him? Is this a step towards something else, like some people have speculated?
No. Well, I mean, there's been so much speculation. None of it's been accurate. But I think if someone called me the other day and said, is he as happy as he appears? And I said, absolutely. I mean, I think he really enjoys it. And look, he can run his program here at North Carolina. You don't have to worry about the analytical department coming in and telling you to throw the ball on first and 10. You don't have to worry about some owner telling you to draft this player. You don't have to worry about anything. You can run your program. And I think he's got complete reign of that. And that's something refreshing. I mean, you know, the NFL has become micromanaged by a lot of different people, and it's hard. You know, when I first started the league in 84, Bill Walsh ran the 49ers. There wasn't a lot of people in his way. Today, there's a lot of people involved.
And yet, with all that said, so many of these coaches seem to want to run away kicking and screaming from the current college model because of NIL and transfer portal. But it seems like Bill Belichick is embracing, and you as well, you're embracing this.
We've lived it our whole lives. I mean, a player could walk into my office wanting a raise. You think that's new to me? I mean, come on. I mean, a player wanting more money. You think that's new to me? Telling a player that he's not going to get more money, you think that's new to me? I mean, it's all the same. I mean, it's actually easy. Here's the difference between college and pro, the way I see it. If I don't draft a guy in the second round and I lose out on that player, you know, I'm done in the draft. I can't replace him. You know, we sat there in the second round in our last draft in Cleveland. Bill and I wanted to draft Curtis Martin, and we missed him. He went before we thought we could get to him. He's a guy in the Hall of Fame. I couldn't replace him, right? And so, but in this thing here, I mean, if I lose a five-star kid down in Alabama, I can find another five-star kid in Georgia.
So, I mean, like, Bill's what, 73 years old, if I'm not mistaken? I think Nick Saban's like a year older than him. Is it out of the question Nick Saban could go back knowing the advantages that you know you have in North Carolina?
I don't know. I mean, Nick knows the college game better than I do. I mean, he's been in a lot longer than I have. I think that's up to Nick. I couldn't answer that.
Do you think, though, like, because everybody accuses him of going away because it's changed so much. And, I mean, he's said as much in so many ways. But, I mean, you make it out to be, it's like, hey, like, this is different now. It's actually advantageous to a guy who coached in the NFL before. Could he adapt to something like that? Would he want to adapt like that? You don't know?
In terms of Bill being in college, Bill's adapted. Bill loves it. I mean, look, it's a different program. I mean, you know, we do the same things. And, you know, you come to our practice is set up like a pro.
Well, and that was my next question. Is this iteration of college football, is this really just another form of professional football right now?
I think it is. I mean, obviously, I think you have to. I mean, you're paying the players. And so when you start paying players, you got to demand that they uphold to it. I mean, this is, you know, we talk to the players all the time about going from pro to amateur. And when you're a pro, you're expected to do it. When you're an amateur, you think you're going to do it. It's a way difference. And so it goes both ways here.
The book, Football Done Right, Setting the Record Straight on Coaches, Players, and the History of the NFL. Michael, we thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, guys.
Michael Lombardi on the Fan Hotline, talking to us about all the stuff that's going on with the Cleveland Browns and obviously North Carolina.
A man who will simmer my annoyance, the dulcet tones of his beautiful voice. You know him as Guardians TV play-by-play man, Matt Underwood. And he joins us now on the Fan Hotline. Matt, welcome to the show.
Oh, good afternoon, Nick. How are you?
We're doing all right here, other than the blood pressure, which might not be entirely tied to the Jeff McNeil thing. It could be some dietary habits, Matt.
It could be. You know, you open the segment by talking about how spicy things are. So you might want to dive into that a little bit.
I do like spice. Well, okay, spice, sweet. I just like food. I wasn't going to lead with the McNeil thing, but Jeff McNeil dancing around at second base. I understand that the Guardians just, I think basically just was like, well, we're going to balk him over to the third so he doesn't steal signs. That seems like a Bush League play to me. And am I in the wrong on this?
Well, it's something that we're seeing more of. I think that, you know, ever since the advent of the PitchCom device, you know, it kind of changed the game from the standpoint of stealing signs, trying to look in and see what, you know, if you could decode what the catcher was putting down in terms of the fingers. Now hitters are looking at the catcher's glove positioning and trying to determine from that what pitch might be coming. And so, you know, there have been instances where, you know, it's happened in our game twice now, and I've seen it in other games where teams just, hey, you know what, let's just balk them over to third. You know, if you're already in scoring position, you get the two outs, it doesn't really give them that much of an advantage. So, whether anything was going on or not, it could have been just gamesmanship, but it was striking because he was jumping up and down and flapping his arms. So, whether he was just trying to get under somebody's skin or whether he was actually potentially relaying signs, you just remove all doubt by just saying, you know, just go to third.
Yeah, so Matt, I disagree with Nick on it. I just feel a little bit differently. Like, I think it's, if they're going to give you the base, do whatever you got to do then. Like, I get you might look like an idiot dancing around, but if Vogt did it in the Astros game and then sent the runner to third, clearly he feels like that's just the extra base isn't worth the hassle to it all, which I would argue I think it should be to him. But if you're going to do it and they're giving bases, I would do that all day if I was Jeff McNeil.
You know, obviously, the one thing that you have to guard against, once you put a guy at third base, now you get the two strikes and you want to bounce a breaking ball. Now you got to be really careful about how you execute that pitch, because if it gets by the catcher, giving them that extra 90 feet, you've given them a little bit of an easier path to come home. So that's the one downside to it. But I think at the same time, you know, it's up to the pitcher and the catcher combination to try to do everything you can to eliminate the idea that they can pick up any kind of tell and relay that to the hitter. So I think it's something that will continue to evolve. Let's put it that way.
Matt, I mentioned the Guardians 17-7 in their last 24 games here. What has led to this surge of high-quality baseball from the Guardians?
I think there's a couple of things at play. I think first and foremost, the thing that has stood out, I think, is the starting pitching has continued to get better and better. Last year, Guardians starting pitchers averaged for the entire season 5 innings per start. This year, we're seeing them push themselves deeper into the game. It might not seem like a lot on the surface. You know, an extra third, two-thirds of an inning, an extra inning, it adds up because the wear and tear on the bullpen lessens to some degree. So I think the fact that they're getting deeper into games also tells you that they're pitching well, pitching better. I've seen the Guardians, you know, shut down teams, and then that team turns around and goes to the next series and goes off offensively. So that, again, tells you that, you know, they're doing something right when it comes to the pitching. So anytime you pitch well, especially from the starting standpoint, it gives you a chance. And this is an offense that, you know, as we've seen all season long, outside of Jose Ramirez and Stephen Kwan, they will struggle to score runs on a consistent basis. And so I think any way you can help alleviate putting the offense under the gun, putting any extra pressure on them, has helped them. So I think also they've hit better with runners in scoring position. You know, when you go through a 10-game losing streak, we can go back and look at those numbers. They were dreadful just putting any runs on the board. And when you don't score, when you don't get the clutch hit to drive in a run early in a game, that pressure, you can just feel it building as the game goes on. So I think they've gotten a few clutch hits, more clutch hits, which has helped, you know, spur. Hey, maybe it's not a big inning like last night where you put up a 5 spot, but you get 2 here, you get 3 there. And with the way they pitched, that's usually enough on a regular basis to hold up.
Do you have optimism that the Guardians will be able to keep Kwan and maybe potentially even extend Kwan?
You know, those conversations happen away from the game. Those are conversations that happen between agents who certainly sometimes have their own agenda, and the guys who run the front office, and obviously ownership is involved too. So there's a lot of moving components. I would love to see that happen. I know in talking to Steven, you know, he's not a guy that is surly or looks at this organization or the city of Cleveland like with disdain or anything of that nature. I think he does like it here, but whether or not what his perceived value and what his agent perceives his value to be lines up with what the organization perceives his value to be, That's a question that, you know, has been debated in this town for a long time. You know, Jose Ramirez took the quote-unquote hometown discount because he wanted to be here. In addition to his unbelievable play, he'll be a franchise icon for the next millennium. It remains to be seen if Stephen Kwan is interested in that kind of a deal.
Matt Underwood on the fan hotline here with Nick and JP breaking down the latest on the Guardians. Slade Ciccone, maybe the box score didn't look as pretty as the first 5 or 6 innings of what Slade did last night. And I looked at his deeper numbers here,
And he's got 82 innings in just 14 starts compared to, like, I want to say it was 22 starts for Gavin Williams, who's got 116 innings. I love what I'm seeing out of Slade. And actually, both Slade and Gavin have kind of turned the corner over these last 10 or so starts. How long before I can start to say Slade is, if not the ace, right below Gavin Williams for the ace of this staff?
Well, it's funny you say that, Nick, because I was literally just about to say he's starting to put himself in the conversation to be the front of the rotation starter. Just by the way he's continuing to grow and the way he's evolving as a pitcher, you know, we've made the comment on the air a few times. He had a start, I want to say it was maybe a month ago, and after the game was over, I remember he told Andre he was kind of kicking himself because he's, you know, and there was one point late in the game, he said, I was chasing a strikeout instead of just looking for weak contact. And that's a light bulb moment for a pitcher because these guys are geared for swing and miss, but swing and miss eats up pitches. And if you can get weak contact, that gets you deeper into the games. And I think he's kind of, it's not that he can't get strikeouts, but the one game where he almost went the distance, he didn't get his first strikeout until, I want to say, the sixth or seventh inning. So I think he's learning, and he's seeing how his stuff plays against big league hitters on a regular basis. And you're right, last night he should have been out of that sixth inning. I mean, and look, I know Brian Rocchio has moved to a different position, but that was a tailor-made double play ball. If Rocchio fields it cleanly, he's out of that inning without giving up a run, and he might shut him out for seven. So I just love what I'm seeing from Slade Ciccone right now.
You know, what's interesting about the offense right now, Matt, is like, yeah, the 5-run inning last night, and it felt like for a while those were just kind of absent. But in the past, I don't know, nearly month or so, you started to get some production out of guys on any given night, and I felt like we used to have that. And what I'm talking about is like Arias last night being the one to step up in a big time way. It feels like you're always going to have J-Ram, you're always going to have Kwan, but there's always somebody else in any given night stepping up, and now they're being able to accomplish that.
When Jose Ramirez doesn't get a hit and you score 7 runs, that's a great night. And I mean, I think that is something that clubhouse can look around and say, hey, you know what? We can do this. We don't have to always put it on Jose to rescue us. And I think the only way that happens, though, to your point, is you have to have productivity from other people like Arias and like Brian Rocchio, who has been swinging the bat very well since he come back from the minor leagues. And, you know, again, I think as Stephen Vogt has said a number of times, it's not easy for these guys because very few of them are playing every single day. They're trying to maximize the matchup value. So, you know, David Fry, even with his value, he's not playing every day. You know, Daniel Schneeman is in and out of the lineup. Angel Martinez is getting more regular everyday playing time. Kyle Manzardo. I think it's not easy for those guys, but they are finding their moments, and those guys have contributed, and that's another reason why this team has won 17 out of 24 games, because you're getting more contribution from people up and down the lineup instead of, well, if Jose doesn't go, this team doesn't go. That wasn't the case last night against a really good team.
Matt, I don't have a lot of criticisms right now because you are playing 17-7 baseball in the last 24. I would like to see Kyle Manzardo every day. Is playing Manzo every day just not in the cards this year for this team?
I guess the way I would answer that, Nick, because we've asked Stephen Vogt about that. And it's not that Stephen Vogt has anything against Kyle Manzardo. He thinks the world of him. It's just the nature of the roster right now with Manzo essentially being, you know, primarily a designated hitter. And you still have Carlos Santana, who gets the lion's share of play at first base. And now you've got C.J. Kafis in the mix as well. The playing time has to be distributed. And, you know, he's not just going to play Kyle Manzardo and keep other people buried on the bench. So I think he's trying as best he can to disperse the workload evenly. I think Kyle Manzardo, though, look, this is a story as old as baseball. If you hit, they find a spot for you in the lineup. And I think if he continues to produce, and I think if he continues to swing the bat well, you know, he's going to continue to get more regular playing time. But it's not going to be like Jose and Kwan. Those are the two guys. They're in there every single day. Outside of that, everybody else has got to kind of check the board when they come in the morning.
Did you have a chance to talk to Frankie before the game, Lindor?
I did not. Not yesterday, no. You know, it's interesting. Andre and I were talking about it on our way in. 2 years ago when we came here, that was still a kind of fresh wound. It was a fresh story. So it was important to go and check in with him and talk to him. And it was like no time had passed since he left Cleveland when we went into the clubhouse and talked to him. It was so awkward, though, because the rest of the New York media was looking at us like, who are these guys and why are they talking to Lindor? But, you know, I think now he's moved on. He's a Met. He's been a Met for a number of years now. And Cleveland has moved on. Outside of Hosey and Santana, there's nobody left on that club that he played with. So I think it's not as much of a story. As I said during the game last night, history connects the present to the past, and he will always be tied to Hosey because of the way those two guys came up and pushed each other. And he spent six wonderful years in Cleveland, so that will always be part of his story and part of his legacy. But he's a Met now, and he's neck deep in it because that team has a $300 million payroll, and they're in a dogfight with the Phillies trying to capture the NL East title. And it's interesting. Think about that, guys. Their payroll is $300 million. I think the Guardians is roughly $100 million. So for that extra $200 million, it has earned the Mets six more wins than the Guardians. Let that sink in.
Matt, let's go to CJ Cephas real quick here. He's got, I want to say, 8 at-bats so far this year. He did get into last night's game as well. I know this is a little early, but what's his role here over the first few weeks as it relates to just how often we might see him?
Yeah, I think he's in the same boat with some of those other guys that we just talked about. You know, he's not going to be in the lineup every single day, but he's a left-handed bat. I think the sort of scouting report on him was a guy who has great bat-to-ball skills, not a lean back and try to hit it out of the ballpark type guy, but similar to a lot of the hitters that the organization has produced in recent years, which is, hopefully a guy that will hit for pretty good average. But we saw the other day, he juiced a ball to deep right field for a double. So he's got good line drive ability. Defensively, he's a natural first baseman, but we talked about the log jam there. So they kind of worked him into right field this year, held his own. And so I think you're going to see probably the bulk of his reps will come in right field, but he'll probably get a few turns at first base as well.
Matt, great stuff, man. Really appreciate your time today. Always great catching up with you, and looking forward to hopefully another Guardians dub tonight.
All right, Nick, keep it spicy, baby. Let's go.
Always. That's the only way we keep it, Matt. Matt Underwood on the fan hotline there. I think the Cephas stuff versus the Manzardo stuff's really interesting.
We got to have that as a drop, by the way. And keep it spicy.
I believe I got a baby at the end there.
Yeah, that we got to incorporate that at some point.
But unlike Russell Wilson, I actually do like it spicy.
Yeah, poor Russ. As the Subway commercials just completely, they died the way his career in Denver did.
Yeah, poor Russ. He's made $300 million. He's married to Sierra.
Yeah, but
He
gets made
fun
of.
Please take care of Russ.
He deserves it, but he gets made fun of a ton for being him.
You could make fun of, if I had $300 million and my wife was Sierra, I wouldn't give a rat's ass what anyone said about.
But the difference the difference is that he does.
Oh yeah,
that's the difference.
That's a fair point. I'm just saying, Russ, you're above it. You've won.
Okay? I saw an interview with Brett Bielema saying it's the only athlete wedding he's ever gone to is Russell Wilson's. And the post wedding dance party, it was legit Earth, Wind, and Fire. Because of course Russell Wilson at Earth, Wind, and Fire come out.
Not enough people are outraged about this with the Guardians. That's in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Well, we appreciate Paul Hoynes ripping himself away from all that great New York stuff to join us right now on the Fan Hotline. He covers the Guardians for the Plain Dealer, Cleveland.com. Hello, Hoynesy.
Hoynesy!
Hi, Jeff, Andy. Sorry about that, man. I forgot. I just forgot.
You're on New York time. It doesn't matter.
You got stuck in a deli. There were no seats, and you had to wait. We understand. First of all, how about a win at Citi Field for the Cleveland Guardians, who, as Tom Hamilton pointed out last night, with Nemo, Lindor, and Soto, the top three guys in the lineup, making more money than the entire Guardians team combined. Outstanding.
That was something else. That was a crazy game. The last time they won a game against the Mets in New York was at Old Shea Stadium when CeCe was on the mound, CeCe Sabathia. So they had lost six straight there. I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but they don't play these guys very much. So that was significant.
CeCe probably had hit a home run for himself in that game, too. Wouldn't shock me.
Could have used them last night.
Oh, man. I want to ask you, when Kwan walks back into the clubhouse after the trade deadline, how much of a boost is that to the guys that are currently on this team?
I think it was a big boost, Andy. He's a big part of that ball club. Just from talking to him, you know, you could see kind of like the weight off coming off his shoulders. He was excited about staying, and I think excited about knowing where he's going to be for at least, you know, through the remainder of this season.
Wainsey, when the trade deadline came and went, and there were a couple of little moves, and we understand we'll get to Bieber in a second, I just thought, wait a minute, look what the Padres gave up for Mason Miller, closer. Look what the Phillies gave up for Duran from the Twins. Man, Emmanuel Clase, had he been able to go, would he have been moved? And I can only imagine the haul that they could have gotten for him.
Yeah, I think they would have seriously considered trading him, Jeff. Just where they are right now, you know, you're still 8 games back in the division, but, you know, 2.5 back in the wild card. And we all know how messy the wild card is. It changes day to day. And I think they would have really seriously considered trading him. And, you know, he would have been the best closer out there. It just, you know, it's kind of a double whammy, you know, that not only do they not have him, but they can't trade him.
Points of their lockers cleaned out, Ortiz, Class A's lockers cleaned out over at Progressive Field. August 31st, they're out until then. I can't think, is there any possible way Major League Baseball says, hey, fellas, you're good to go? You're back in September, or even that you're back next year?
Yeah, I can't see that happening.
Me neither.
Jeff, I mean, I'd be surprised if it happened. I mean, and, you know, you got to presume these guys are innocent until proven otherwise. MLB doesn't make a habit of taking guys off the field for nothing, you know, with Ortiz and Class A. Obviously, something's going on. We've got a pretty good indication of what they were doing. You know, the Ortiz gets swept up first. Then the Ortiz investigation leads to Class A. He gets swept up in this thing. Who knows what's going to happen. Just from talking to different people, you know, no one would be surprised if this thing gets extended beyond August 31st.
Are people making too much out of the fact that their lockers were cleaned out? Like, Hoynesy, I've seen them have guys on the roster that, like, weren't there for, you have too, obviously, for a year that still had a locker that they didn't take the name off of. I mean, that's... You tell me.
Yeah, no, you know, I thought that kind of stood out like a sore thumb, definitely. You know, you even took the name tags off. You know, it's not like they're running out of space in there. That thing is like, the Taj Mahal, the new locker room. So, they did the same thing with the guys that were traded, Seawald and Bieber. They cleaned out their lockers and took out the name tags. But, you know, seeing Class A and Ortiz's lockers cleaned out, you know, and I mean, they hadn't touched them, you know, since Ortiz got caught up in this thing in what was that, July? So July 3rd. So, you know, that was significant, I thought. There was, they know more than we know. I don't think they know a whole lot, the ball club, but I think this was just, a way of, closing the door and saying, hey, we've got 26 guys here. These are the 26 guys that are going to, you know, finish this season, and we can't count on anybody coming back.
Paul Hoynes joining us, covers the Guardians for the Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Hoynesy, what was the biggest push behind the trade for Shane Bieber? Was it that maybe they didn't think he would be able to pitch this year and help them? Was it that he wasn't going to pick up his option, or might it have been they were afraid he would pick up his option?
Yeah, I think all of those played into it, Jeff. Yeah. It's such a weird kind of deal. You know, you put what you put two almost two a year and a half of rehab into a guy. You know, you want to see him pitch. He's on the doorstep of pitching well. You know, of coming back and finally helping you out. And then you make the trade. I really think it was the contract. I thought, you know, probably Bieber, you know, if there was enough interest to trade for him when he hasn't pitched since what, April of 2024, if there was enough teams interested in him, there were going to be enough teams that would have paid him at the end of the season and paid him more than what the $16 million player option he was going to get in 2026. So I think that played the predominant role.
Oinsie, it's interesting. I was just kind of looking through the lineup from last night, and I believe for the majority of the game, they only had one guy that was hitting under 200. Because these numbers have come up a little bit.
Hey,
you know, I'm just, within the game itself. Yeah, oh. they have multiple guys that are hitting under 200. But I think if you had a lineup of nine at one point, there was only one moment there where eight of the nine guys were hitting over 200. Why is the offense getting a little bit better?
The bar is very low.
The bar is very, very low. But at least I don't feel bad when I see Rocchio stepping up there at 231 now the way I was before.
We're taking baby steps here, right? I think the whole club is playing better. I mean, they've won five of their last six, 17 of their last 24. They've hit the good spot. I mean, outside of the Mets obviously are loaded, but this has been the soft spot in the schedule. You know, they'd kind of gone through the ringer in the first half as concerning playing clubs with 500 or better records. And, they're playing better and they're pitching better. I mean, Ciccone, has just done a great job for them, I think. I mean, if you had to talk about the biggest surprises on the ball club, I think he'd be at the top of the list.
Well, Andy and I were just kicking around in our last segment. The one thing that, and they've been treading water, they're still right there in the wild card race. They could make the playoffs. That's all terrific. But if you look at guys who have had opportunities this year to win a job and to eliminate any questions, like, Rocchio, shortstop, Arias, shortstop or second base, Angel Martinez, what's going on in center, right field, I don't know that they've answered any questions with their position player group this year. And I think that's a shame because I was hoping there would be some this year.
Yeah, I think Arias is kind of won the shortstop job. I like the way he's played there. But, I think that's almost a product of the way Boat manages, that really nobody has a regular job except, Kwan and Jose Ramirez. And but everybody else, and Santana, I guess, at first base, but everybody else changes positions on a nightly basis. And I don't know if that's conducive to guys just saying this is, I should be in right field every day. I just don't know if that's part of it. But, I think Arias, the fact that when he came back from the ankle injury and they immediately put him back at shortstop and moved Rocchio to second base, I thought that was significant to me.
Let's talk about the Nick Enright story from last night. I what a great emotional story, and for a guy that has really battled hard off the field to make sure that he even had a chance to be playing baseball right now, when you're dealing with Hodgkin lymphoma. I just like that story last night. I don't know how your clubhouse and your teammates can't be inspired by him.
Yeah, that was a great outing by him. And, they gave him the beer shower after the game. You could hear them hooting and hollering in the locker room while we were talking to Vogt after the game outside the locker room. They're going to depend on this guy, Andy. Because without Class A, you're looking at Heron's down in Columbus. You're looking at a bullpen, with Cade Smith, Gattis, Sabrowski, and now Enright. They're going to have to carry the load at the end of the game. And, big ups to Enright. Just did a great job. He was so fired up after the game last night when he was talking to us. You could really tell it meant a lot to him. And, what Boat said after the game, he goes, what this guy's been through, I think he can handle pitching in the 10th inning against the Mets at City Field. I mean, he's going to be able to slow the game down. I mean, you saw him, the intentional balk to third base. Where'd that come from?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the second one we've seen, right?
Yeah, but they must think guys are stealing signs, right? That's the only reason why you're doing that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Caused a fight the first time we saw it earlier this week.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You know, Cade Smith did it against Houston, I think. So, you know, I thought we don't, you know, that was the sole property of Bob Wickman back in what?
Oh, man.
Back in the Metrodome.
It was an intentional balk. I'm like, what?
Paul Hoynes is joining us from the plaindealercleveland.com. Hoynesy, with Chase DeLauder out for a while, there goes that idea of seeing if he can be an everyday player. But Jonathan Rodriguez back to Columbus as Kafis comes up. Johnkenzie Noel has been trying to find it all year, you know, at various times. He's in Columbus. Do you think, barring injury, that Noel and Rodriguez are done as far as high level prospects? And do you take DeLauder out of that because of the continuing injury and just keep kind of rolling and looking for somebody in right field?
Yeah, I think you've got to, Andy. You've got to do that. I mean, you know, I don't think Big Christmas got a fair shot here, you know, but, you know, I would think they've got to draw that conclusion. Jonathan Rodriguez, I mean, you know, those guys are in such tough positions. They're used to playing every day in the minors. They come up here, they play, what, twice a week? You've got to produce. You're facing the best pitching in the world. You just it's a tough, you know, only certain guys can do that. And I always think, why are you putting a rookie in that position? Why don't you get a veteran guy that can do it, you know, that has done this, that has been through the mill, that can sit and still be productive? But they never do that. And I don't know if that's, you know, they don't want to pay that guy, or it's just they want to recycle these. You know, they're just looking for, you know, lightning in a bottle.
Lindor in a Mets uniform still looks bad to me, Hoynesy.
Oh, my goodness. He tried his hardest to beat them last night, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, that guy, you forget what kind of player he is, Jeff. He's a good player. He's, you know, just think if you have Jose and Lindor still on the left side of that infield. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, dare to dream, right, Paul? Hey, buddy, thank you for your time today.
Thanks,
we appreciate it, as always. Enjoy New York.
Sorry about being late, guys. Thank
no
you.
Worry. That's no, all right. Never worry.
We appreciate it. Paul Hoynes joining us on the Fan Hotline, and Hoynesy in New York covering the Guardians against the Mets. But we appreciate Paul Hoynes ripping himself away from all that great New York stuff to join us right now on the Fan Hotline. He covers the Guardians for the plaindealercleveland.com. Hello, Hoynesy.
Hoynesy!
Hi, Jeff. Andy. Sorry about that, man. I forgot. I just forgot.
You're on New York time. It doesn't matter.
You got stuck in a deli. There were no seats, and you had to wait. We understand. First of all, how about a win at Citi Field for the Cleveland Guardians, who, as Tom Hamilton pointed out last night, with Nemo, Lindor, and Soto, the top three guys in the lineup, making more money than the entire Guardians team combined. Outstanding.
That was something else. That was a crazy game. The last time they won a game against the Mets in New York was at Old Shea Stadium when CeCe was on the mound, CeCe Sabathia. So they had lost six straight there. I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but, you know, they don't play these guys very much. So that was significant.
CeCe probably had hit a home run for himself in that game too. Wouldn't shock me.
Could have used him last night.
Oh, man. I want to ask you, when Kwan walks back into the clubhouse after the trade deadline, how much of a boost is that to the guys that are currently on this team?
I think it was a big boost, Andy. He's a big part of that ball club. You know, just from talking to him, you know, you could see kind of like the weight off coming off his shoulders. He was excited about staying, and I think excited about knowing where he's going to be for at least, you know, through the remainder of this season.
Hoynesy, when the trade deadline came and went, and there were a couple of little moves, and we understand we'll get to Bieber in a second, I just thought, wait a minute, look what the Padres gave up for Mason Miller, closer. Look what the Phillies gave up for Duran from the Twins. Man, Emmanuel Clase, had he been able to go, would he have been moved? And I can only imagine the haul that they could have gotten for him.
Yeah, I think they would have seriously considered trading him, Jeff. You know, just where they are right now, you know, you're still 8 games back in the division, but, you know, 2.5 back in the wild card. And we all know how messy the wild card is. It changes day to day. And I think they would have really seriously considered trading him. And, you know, he would have been the best closer out there. It just, you know, it's kind of a double whammy, you know, that not only do they not have him, but they can't trade him.
Going to their lockers cleaned out, Ortiz Class A's lockers cleaned out over at Progressive Field. August 31st, they're out until then. I can't think, is there any possible way Major League Baseball says, hey, fellas, you're good to go? You're back in September, or even that you're back next year?
Yeah, I can't see that happening.
Me neither.
Jeff, I mean, I'd be surprised if it happened. I mean, and, you know, you got to presume these guys are innocent until proven otherwise. MLB doesn't make a habit of taking guys off the field for nothing, you know, with Ortiz and Class A. Obviously, something's going on. We've got a pretty good indication of what they were doing. You know, the Ortiz gets swept up first. Then the Ortiz investigation leads to Class A. He gets swept up in this thing. Who knows what's going to happen. Just from talking to different people, you know, no one would be surprised if this thing gets extended beyond August 31st.
Are people making too much out of the fact that their lockers were cleaned out? Like, Hoynesy, I've seen them have guys on the roster that, like, weren't there for – you have, too, obviously, for a year that still had a locker that they didn't take the name off of. I mean, that's – you tell me.
Yeah, no, you know, I thought that kind of stood out like a sore thumb, definitely. You know, you even took the name tags off. You know, it's not like they're running out of space in there. That thing is like, the Taj Mahal, the new locker room. So, they did the same thing with the guys that were traded, Seawald and Bieber. You know, they cleaned out their lockers and took out the name tags. But, you know, seeing Class A and Ortiz's lockers cleaned out, you know, and I mean, they hadn't touched them, you know, since Ortiz was you know, got caught up in this thing. And what was that, July? So July 3rd. So, you know, that was significant, I thought. There was, they know more than we know. You know, I don't think they know a whole lot, the ball club, but I think this was just, a way of, closing the door and saying, hey, we've got 26 guys here. These are the 26 guys that are going to, you know, finish this season, and we can't count on anybody coming back.
Paul Hoynes joining us, covers the Guardians for the Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Hoynesy, what was the biggest push behind the trade for Shane Bieber? Was it that maybe they didn't think he would be able to pitch this year and help them? Was it that he wasn't going to pick up his option, or might it have been they were afraid he would pick up his option?
Yeah, I think all of those played into it, Jeff. Yeah. It's such a weird kind of deal. You know, you put what you put a year and a half of rehab into a guy. You know, you want to see him pitch. He's on the doorstep of pitching well. You know, of coming back and finally helping you out. And then you make the trade. I really think it was the contract. I thought, you know, probably Bieber, you know, if there was enough interest to trade for him when he hasn't pitched since, what, April of 2024, if there was enough teams interested in him, there were going to be enough teams that would have, paid him at the end of the season and paid him more than, what, the $16 million the player option he was going to get in 2026. So I think that played the predominant role.
Hoynesy, it's interesting. I was just kind of looking through the lineup from last night, and I believe for the majority of the game, they only had one guy that was hitting under 200 because these numbers have come up a little bit.
Hey!
You know, I'm just, within the game itself, yeah, they have multiple guys that are hitting under 200, but I think if you had a lineup of 9 at one point – there was only one moment there where 8 of the 9 guys were hitting over 200. Why is the offense getting a little bit better? The bar is very low. The bar is very, very low. But at least I don't feel bad when I see Rocchio stepping up there at 231 now the way I was before.
We're taking baby steps here, right?
Wow.
You know, I think, the whole club is playing better. I mean, they've won 5 of their last 6, 17 of their last 24. They've hit the good spot. I mean, outside of the Mets obviously are loaded. But this has been the soft spot in the schedule. You know, they've kind of gone through the ringer in the first half as concerning playing clubs with 500 or better records. And, they're playing better and they're pitching better. I mean, Ciccone, has just done a great job for them, I think. I mean, if you had to talk about the biggest surprises on the ball club, I think he'd be at the top of the list.
Well, Andy and I were just kicking around in our last segment. The one thing that and they've been treading water. They're still right there in the wild card race. They could make the playoffs. That's all terrific. But if you look at guys who have had opportunities this year to win a job and to eliminate any questions, like Rocchio, shortstop, Arias, shortstop or second base, Angel Martinez, what's going on in center, right field? I don't know that they've answered any questions with their position player group this year, and I think that's a shame because I was hoping there would be some this year.
Yeah, I think Arias is kind of won the shortstop job. I really
you do.
I like the way he's played there, but I think that's almost a product of the way Boat manages. You know that really nobody has a regular job except Kwan and Jose Ramirez. And but everybody else and Santana, I guess, at first base. But everybody else changes positions on a nightly basis, and I don't know if that's conducive to guys just saying this is I should be in right field every day. I just don't know if that's part of it. But I think Arias, the fact that when he came back from the ankle injury and they immediately put him back at shortstop and moved Rocchio to second base, I thought that was that was significant to me.
Let's talk about the Nick Enright story from last night. What a great emotional story, and for a guy that has really battled hard off the field to make sure that he even had a chance to be playing baseball right now. When you're dealing with Hodgkin lymphoma, I just like that story last night. I don't know how your clubhouse and your teammates can't be inspired by him.
Yeah, that was a great, great outing by him. And, they gave him the beer shower after the game. You could hear them hooting and hollering in the locker room while we were talking to Vogt after the game outside the locker room. They're going to depend on this guy, Andy. Because without Class A, you're looking at Heron's down in Columbus. You're looking at a bullpen, with Cade Smith, Gattis, Sabrowski, and now Enright. They're going to have to carry the load at the end of the game. And, big ups to Enright. Just did a great job. He was so fired up after the game last night when he was talking to us. You could really tell it meant a lot to him. And, what Boat said after the game, he goes, what this guy has been through, I think he can handle pitching in the 10th inning against the Mets at City Field. I mean, he's going to be able to slow the game down. I mean, you saw him, the intentional balk to third base. Where'd that come from?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the second one we've seen, right?
Yeah, but they must think guys are stealing signs, right? That's the only reason why you're doing that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Caused a fight the first time we saw it earlier this week.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Cade Smith did it against Houston, I think. So, I thought that was the sole property of Bob Wickman back in what?
Oh, man.
Back in the Metrodome.
It was an intentional balk. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Paul Hoynes is joining us from the Plain Dealer, Cleveland.com. Hoynesy, with Chase DeLauder out for a while, there goes that idea of seeing if he can be an everyday player. But Jonathan Rodriguez back to Columbus as Kephas comes up. Johnkenzie Noel has been trying to find it all year, at various times. He's in Columbus. Do you think, barring injury, that Noel and Rodriguez are done as far as high-level prospects? And do you take DeLauder out of that because of the continuing injury and just keep kind of rolling and looking for somebody in right field?
Yeah, I think you've got to, Andy. You've got to do that. I mean, you know, I don't think Big Christmas got a fair shot here, you know, but, you know, I would think they've got to draw that conclusion. Jonathan Rodriguez, I mean, you know, those guys are in such tough positions. They're used to playing every day in the minors. They come up here, they play, what, twice a week? You've got to produce. You're facing the best pitching in the world. You just it's a tough, you know, only certain guys can do that. And I always think, why are you putting a rookie in that position? Why don't you get a veteran guy that can do it? You know, that has done this, that has been through the mill, that can sit and still be productive. But they never do that. And I don't know if that's, you know, they don't want to pay that guy or it's just they want to recycle these. You know, they're just looking for, you know, lightning in a bottle.
Lindor in a Mets uniform still looks bad to me, Hoynsie.
Oh, my goodness. He tried his hardest to beat them last night, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, that guy. You forget what kind of player he is, Jeff. He's a good player. He's, you know, just think if you have Jose and Lindor still on the left side of that infield. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, dare to dream, right, Paul? Hey, buddy, thank you for your time today.
Thanks,
we appreciate it as always. Enjoy New York.
Sorry about being late, guys. Thank
no,
you.
That's no, all right. Never worry.
We appreciate it, Paul Hoynes. Joining us on the Fan Hotline, and Hoynsie in New York covering the Guardians against the Mets.